head to Hoover on 2192.
We hope to have this thing wrapped up today, but we probably won't get it before the first of the week.
How many shots were fired?
Three.
Any of them fired at me?
No, there was another.
All three at the present?
All three at the present, and we have them. And we have the gun here also.
That's J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI. It's the afternoon of November the 29th, 1963, a week after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and Hoover is on the phone with President Lyndon Johnson. Like every other American, President Johnson is full of questions. How many shots were fired? Where were they fired from? And Johnson's got some additional questions that are of special importance to him. For example, he was riding in the motorcade too, so naturally he was keen to know whether any of the shots had been fired at him. Hoover was able to assure him that none of them had. All three shots had been fired at President Kennedy. Beyond that, Johnson had his country to worry about. He had to work out if the assassination had been arranged by some foreign power. So he was eager to know what the deal was with Oswald's Cuban sympathies.
He was connected with the Cuban operation with money you were trying to...
That's what we're trying to nail down now. Because he was strongly pro-Castro, he was strongly anti-American, and he had been in correspondence, which we have, with the Soviet embassy here in Washington, and with this committee for fair play to Cuba. We have copies of the correspondence. So we've got him nailed down in his contact with them. None of those letters, however, dealt with any indication of violence or contemplated assassination.
Most of the correspondence Hoover was talking about was written by Oswald during the 5 months he spent in New Orleans between April and September of 1963. In the previous episode of the podcast, I showed how wrong the conspiracy theorists are when they claim that Oswald had no discernible motive to shoot President Kennedy. I spent more than an hour demonstrating how ridiculous that suggestion is, and I didn't even get to the New Orleans period, which is the richest vein of information we have about why Oswald did what he did. His wife Marina had insisted on moving to New Orleans after Oswald took his unsuccessful gunshot at the right-wing Dallas demagogue General Edwin Walker on April the 10th. Marina thought that moving to another state would prevent Oswald from being tempted to take another shot at Walker. And in a way, her plan worked. In New Orleans, Oswald's obsession with Walker cooled off. Unfortunately, it was replaced by another obsession, Cuba. That was the word that the needle got stuck on now in the scratched record of Oswald's one-track mind. Cuba, Cuba, Cuba. If we want to know what was going on in Oswald's head when he shot the president in November, the 5 months he spent in New Orleans between April and September give us the final piece of the puzzle. My name is David Free, and this is The Ghosts of Dallas. On April the 25th, 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald arrived in New Orleans by bus. The next 5 months of his life were packed with psychodrama. I sketched out the rough details of this period back in episode 1 of the podcast. The period was dominated by Oswald's increasingly frantic desire to get himself to Cuba. For a while, he considered the option of hijacking a plane and diverting it to Havana. He even tried to persuade Marina, who was heavily pregnant at the time, to serve as his armed sidekick on that operation. Finally, Oswald ditched the hijacking idea and settled on the less wacky alternative of heading to the nearest Cuban embassy, which was down in Mexico City. He would tell the staff there that he was traveling to the Soviet Union via Cuba and needed a Cuban transit visa for that purpose, and when he got to Cuba, he planned to stay there for good. He seemed confident that the regime of Fidel Castro would approve of him so much that they wouldn't kick him out. We know what ended up happening down in Mexico City, though. The Cubans refused to grant Oswald a visa, and so did the Soviets. He ended up back in Dallas and the rest is history. When Oswald went down to Mexico, he took along with him a kind of resume or dossier that was full of letters and other papers that documented his activities as a left-wing man of action in New Orleans. This was the correspondence file that ended up in the hands of J. Edgar Hoover after the assassination. Oswald believed that this file would impress the Cubans so much that they would A. grant him a transit visa immediately and B. let him stay in Cuba permanently once he got there. Oswald had put a lot of work into assembling this resume, so it's no wonder that he was a bit stunned when it failed to make any impression on the people at the Cuban embassy. To understand the importance that Oswald placed on this collection of papers, we need to understand an incident from his past that clarifies a lot of his later behaviour. Back in 1959, when he'd gone to Moscow and tried to defect to the Soviet Union, the Soviets had asked to see papers proving his Marxist credentials, and Oswald had had nothing to show them. He'd been badly burned by that episode, and he was determined that he wasn't going to make the same mistake when he presented himself to the Cubans in Mexico. In fact, his whole life after that moment in Russia can be thought of as an effort to prove to the world that he really was the high-achieving radical that he privately believed himself to be. His attempt on the life of General Walker was part of that effort, and his assassination of Kennedy was the absurd culmination of it. And during the five-month period that he spent in New Orleans, nearly every move Oswald made was made for the purpose of fattening up the pile of papers that he intended to take with him down to Mexico City. He kept a handwritten record of his radical activities, listing them under headings like Marxist, Lecturer, Street Agitation, and Radio Speaker. He wrote a flurry of letters to various left-wing organizations, and he religiously kept their replies. He staged public protests and provoked confrontations with anti-Castro activists. At one point, he posed as a committed anti-Castro man himself and made a comical effort to infiltrate a local Cuban exile group. He got himself arrested and thrown in jail. He got himself mentioned in local newspapers, and he carefully preserved the clippings. The story of Oswald in New Orleans is a story of covert action and devious self-promotion. His self-publicity campaign in the city reached a peak when he managed to jag an appearance on local TV, which was quickly followed by a couple of radio appearances. On the radio, Oswald presented himself falsely as the official New Orleans representative of an organization called the Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
How many people do you have in your committee here in New Orleans?
I cannot reveal that as secretary of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Now let me ask you a second question. Who is the secretary of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, the national secretary?
Well, we have a national director who is Mr. V.T. Lee.
The Fair Play for Cuba Committee was an American pro-Castro group based in New York. Its national director really was, as Oswald just said, a man named V.T. Lee. Even if that name does sound suspiciously like one of Oswald's aliases. In fact, it sounds exactly like one of his aliases. You may remember that a few months later, at the time of the assassination, Oswald was registered at his rooming house under the name O.H. Lee. O.H. Lee was a mashup of his own name, obviously, but we'd be pretty dense if we didn't also notice that it was a kind of secret tribute to Mr. V.T. Lee of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, just as Oswald's main alias, A.J. Hiddell, was an obvious tribute to Fidel Castro himself. Oswald's association with V.T. Lee and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee began in May 1963, a month after he'd arrived in New Orleans. On May the 26th, he wrote a letter to the committee's head office in New York. The letter was typical of Oswald's impatient, level-jumping style. He began by humbly applying for membership in the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and just a paragraph later, he was announcing that he wanted to open a branch of the committee in New Orleans, featuring himself as head honcho. "Dear sirs," Oswald's letter said, "I am requesting formal membership in your organization. Now that I live in New Orleans, I have been thinking about renting a small office at my own expense for the purpose of forming an FPCC branch here in New Orleans. Could you give me a charter? Oswald also asked to be sent a consignment of Fair Play for Cuba Committee pamphlets and a generous supply of blank membership forms. He thought that he'd be needing those to cover the flurry of membership applications that would come in as soon as he established the committee's New Orleans branch. Also, he added, a picture of Fidel, suitable for framing, would be a nice touch. A few days later, V.T. Lee wrote back to Oswald from New York. The tone of his reply was cautious. He could obviously sense that he was dealing with a potential nut job. He accepted Oswald's application to become a member, and he enclosed a membership card for him, but he didn't humour Oswald any further than that. He refused to give him a charter to open a New Orleans branch. As he explained, there just wasn't enough pro-Castro sentiment in that city to justify opening a branch there. In fact, New Orleans was a hotbed of anti-Castro sentiment. After Miami, New Orleans had the second largest concentration of Cuban exiles in the United States, and for obvious reasons, the Cuban exiles didn't share Oswald's rosy view of Castro and his regime. So V.T. Lee advised Oswald to keep a low profile in New Orleans, and he warned him to keep an eye out for the, quote, lunatic fringe of Cuban exiles there. I definitely would not recommend an office, he added firmly. He was wasting his ink, though, because that wasn't the answer that Oswald wanted to hear. In fact, Oswald didn't even wait for Mr. Lee's reply to reach him before he went ahead and made his next move. On May the 29th, just a few days after sending off his own letter to New York, Oswald went to a local printing shop and he ordered 1,000 copies of a self-designed handbill that said, quote, "Hands off Cuba. Join the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, New Orleans Charter Member Branch. Free literature and lectures. Everyone welcome." 1,000 copies of this handbill cost Oswald $10. He also got the printer to run him up a batch of blank membership cards and application forms. As the secretary of his fake New Orleans branch of the FPCC, Oswald installed himself. And as the branch president, he appointed his old imaginary chum, A.J. Hidell. Oswald got Marina to do Hidell's signature on the paperwork, thus fleshing out the illusion that his rogue New Orleans branch of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee had more than one member. On Sunday, June the 16th, Oswald took a bunch of his freshly printed hands-off Cuba leaflets down to a wharf in New Orleans. A U.S. aircraft carrier was docked there, and Oswald started offering copies of his leaflet to passing sailors. This was a deliberately provocative move. Oswald was obviously trying to produce some kind of violent or newsworthy response. But the police moved him on before anything like that could happen. By now, Oswald had received that letter from the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New York, the one that denied him permission to open a branch in New Orleans and advised him to keep a low profile there. But Oswald clearly intended to do exactly the opposite. In fact, he was already doing it. There are conspiracy theorists who say that Oswald wasn't a real left-winger. They say that he was a CIA or an FBI plant who was merely pretending to be a left-winger as part of a vastly elaborate conspiracy to discredit the American left. They're wrong about the second part, but there's a limited sense in which they're right about the first part. Oswald certainly wasn't a typical left-winger. This wasn't a man who had any interest at all in being a team player. He had no desire to develop a fruitful long-term working relationship with the FPCC or with any other leftist group. The letters he wrote to left-wing organizations during this period were nothing more than a means to a personal end for Oswald. They were a way of building up the paperwork for the file that he intended to take with him down to Mexico. If your definition of a good left-winger is someone who falls into line and follows the orders of people higher up the food chain, then Oswald was a terrible left-winger. In fact, it's hilarious that a man who was so fundamentally self-centered thought that collectivist politics were a good thing to be interested in. None of this means, though, that Oswald wasn't a hardcore ideologue. He clearly believed that he was a real left-winger, and he believed it very fervently. In fact, he almost certainly believed that he was a realer left-winger than people like V.T. Lee, because he walked the talk instead of just talking it. He'd already spent 3 years of his life in Russia, and he desperately wanted to spend the rest of it in Cuba. And a couple of months earlier, he'd come within a whisker of gunning down a real-life American reactionary. You could say that Oswald's radicalism was essentially just a mechanism for getting his own way and for validating his violent tendencies and his personal will to power. But you could say the same thing about Lenin or Mao, and perhaps even about Castro himself. If Oswald wasn't a real left-winger, then neither were they. On June the 24th, a week after his failed attempt to provoke some kind of incident down on the docks, Oswald took his Cuba plan up another notch by applying for a new passport. As proof of his vaccination status, he attached a bogus immunization certificate signed by none other than Dr. A.J. Hedel. Just after renewing his passport, Oswald played a dirty little trick on Marina that says a lot about his character. For some time, Oswald had been trying to persuade Marina to go back to live in the USSR by herself, that is, with their daughter, but without Oswald. And Marina absolutely didn't want to do that. Back in February, when he was planning the murder of General Walker, Oswald had made Marina write a letter to the Soviet embassy in Washington, applying for visas for herself and June so that they could return to the USSR. At the time, Marina didn't know why Oswald was so keen to pack her and June off to the USSR, because she didn't know about his plan to murder General Walker. But in retrospect, we can see what he was up to. He knew that it was likely that he would be either captured or killed after shooting Walker, and he wanted to assure himself that Marina and their daughter would be looked after by the Soviets. Oswald didn't have many redeeming qualities, but it's only fair to admit that he did care about his wife and daughter. Not enough to take care of them himself, but enough to hope that somebody else would, while he followed his dreams in the field of political homicide. Anyway, when Marina applied for those visas in February, the embassy wrote back to her, asking her to explain the reasons why she wanted to go back to the Soviet Union. And ever since then, she'd been dragging the chain on writing them a reply. In New Orleans, Oswald again started badgering Marina to get on with writing that letter. Because, of course, now that he wanted to nick off to Cuba, he had a new reason for hoping that the Soviets would look after his family. When Marina again refused to write back to the embassy, Oswald brought matters to a head in an extraordinary way. On the night of June the 30th, he broke down sobbing. Marina asked him what was wrong, and Oswald told her that he was a lost man and he didn't know what to do. And he said that he was now ready to go back to the USSR with her and June. There was nothing to keep him in America anymore, he said. We'll be together in Russia, he said. You and me and Junie and the baby. How would I manage without my girls, he said. Marina was overjoyed. She danced around the room. The next morning, with Oswald hanging over her shoulder, Marina sat down and finally wrote her reply to the Soviet embassy, explaining that she was homesick for Mother Russia and requesting visas for herself and the family. My husband expresses a sincere wish to return together with me to the USSR, she wrote. I earnestly beg you to help him in this. Oswald took Marina's letter and he told her that he would put it in the post. But this is where he played his dirty trick on her, because before he put the letter in the post, he slipped a separate note of his own into the envelope. It said, quote, "Dear sirs, please rush the entrance visa for the return of Soviet citizen Marina N. Oswald. She's going to have a baby in October, therefore you must grant the entrance visa and make the transportation arrangements before then. As for my return entrance visa, please consider it separately. Thank you. Lee H. Oswald, husband of Marina Nikolaevna." For good measure, Oswald underlined the word separately. It is possible to overcomplicate the question of why Oswald shot Kennedy. Yes, there were a lot of complex factors at play, and it's useful to discuss as many of those as we can. But at the same time, we should never lose sight of the basic fact that Oswald really was a horrible, devious, lying, manipulative, self-centered little sack of shit. And this trick that he played on Marina with the embassy letter gives us a timely reminder of what a terrible person he was. Oswald knew what a hellhole the Soviet Union was. He was damned if he was going to go back to the place himself, but he had no compunction about tricking his pregnant wife and their little daughter into going back to that hellhole alone so that he could go ahead with his plan to lie his way into Cuba and become a high-ranking member of the Castro junta. This is a man who genuinely seems to have been born without a moral conscience. Other people, including his wife and daughter, didn't seem to exist for Oswald except as means to an end or as obstacles in the way of it. And right now, the only end in Oswald's mind was Cuba. Marina said of this period, quote, "His basic desire was to get to Cuba by any means, and all the rest of it was window dressing for that purpose." Actually, the window dressing metaphor is quite close to the literal truth, if you accept that the window that Oswald was dressing was the file of paperwork that he planned to take with him down to the Cuban embassy. In July, he wrote another letter to the FPCC headquarters in New York. It was a bold letter. Oswald began by informing Mr. V.T. Lee that he'd simply ignored his advice about keeping a low profile in New Orleans. "I hope you won't be too disapproving at my innovations," Oswald wrote, "but I do think they are necessary for this area. As per your advice, I have taken a P.O. box. Against your advice, I have decided to take an office from the very beginning." As evidence of his innovations, Oswald enclosed a copy of his self-produced hands-off Cuba leaflet. "As you see from the circular," he wrote, "I have jumped the gun on the charter business, but I don't think it's too important. You may think the circular is too provocative, but I wanted it to attract attention, even if it is the attention of the lunatic fringe." At the Fair Play for Cuba Committee headquarters in New York, V.T. Lee was so thoroughly pissed off by Oswald's letter that he didn't reply to it. Nor did he change his mind about giving Oswald an official charter to run a New Orleans branch. In fact, Lee totally washed his hands of Oswald at this point. Although Oswald kept writing letters to him, Lee never sent him another reply. But Oswald didn't seem to notice that V.T. Lee was ghosting him, or maybe he just didn't care. Either way, he continued writing letters to the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and he tried to keep them up to date with all the stuff he was doing in New Orleans on Castro's behalf. In a letter dated August the 1st, Oswald told the committee about his attempt to, quote, "picket the fleet" down on the wharf. He also described a pretty dramatic-sounding clash that he'd had on the street with some local anti-Castro Cubans. He wrote, "Through the efforts of some Cuban exile Usanos, a street demonstration was attacked, and we were officially cautioned by the police. The incident robbed me of what support I had, leaving me alone." Usano is the Spanish word for worm. It was one of Fidel Castro's favorite terms of abuse. The great man had recently started using it to describe any Cuban who wasn't fully on board with his revolution. Oswald's story about the clash on the street with the Cuban exile Usanos is interesting for two reasons. The first is that the incident hadn't really happened. Oswald had invented it out of thin air. But the second and far more interesting thing about this story is that immediately after describing it in his letter to the FPCC, Oswald started taking elaborate steps to make sure that an incident like this would happen for real. It was August the 4th when he mailed off the letter describing his made-up clash with the Usanos. The next day, August the 5th, Oswald walked into a New Orleans clothing store that was run by a Cuban exile named Carlos Bringier, and he proceeded to do something very sneaky.
"I had the opportunity to meet Lee Harvey Oswald on four different times in New Orleans. The first time was when he tried to infiltrate the Cuban Student Directorate.
That's Carlos Bringuier speaking after the assassination. I had the opportunity to meet Oswald four times, he says, and the first time was when he tried to infiltrate the Cuban Student Directorate. The Cuban Student Directorate was an anti-Castro organization whose headquarters were in Miami. Bringuier was its representative in New Orleans, and his clothing store was a hub for the local exile community. When Oswald walked into his store on August the 5th, Bringuier was having a conversation with two local high school kids who were interested in joining the struggle against Castro. Oswald barged straight into their conversation. "Is this the Cuban exile headquarters?" he said. And then he proceeded to make a very big deal of trying to persuade Bringuier and the two high school kids that he was a passionate anti-Castro man himself. He told them that he'd served in the Marines and was willing to make himself useful by training anti-Castro rebels in the art of guerrilla warfare. He said that he was ready to go to Cuba to join the fight against Castro personally. He talked about the techniques that he would use there to derail trains and blow up bridges. He talked about how easy it was to make homemade gunpowder. Oswald was so gung-ho that Bringuier smelled a rat. He suspected that Oswald must be some kind of pro-Castro agent. "I had some feeling that I could not trust him," he said later. Bringuier told Oswald that his organization didn't involve itself in military activities. It was strictly an information service. Oswald put his hand into his pocket and offered to make a cash donation, but Bringuier told him to send his money to the organization's headquarters in Miami. Oswald left, but he promised to come back the next day to lend Bringuier his personal copy of the Marine Guidebook, which was full of handy hints about things like combat tactics and hand-to-hand fighting. When Oswald came back the next day, Bringuier wasn't there, so he left his guidebook with one of Bringuier's assistants. Carlos Bringuier was dead right to suspect that Oswald was up to something, of course, and it didn't take him long to find out what that something was. 3 days later, at around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Oswald staged one of his one-man pro-Castro protests on a street corner near Bringuier's store. He had a sign hanging round his neck that said, "Viva Fidel," and he started offering copies of his Hands Off Cuba pamphlet to passing pedestrians. A friend of Bringuier saw this protest happening, and he rushed down to Carlos's store to tell him that some clown was handing out pro-Fidel leaflets on the street. Bringuier and his friends grabbed some anti-Fidel placards, and they went down to stage a little counter-protest of their own. When they got there, Bringuier was gobsmacked to discover that the guy with the Viva Fidel sign hanging round his neck was Oswald.
The day that Oswald tried to infiltrate our organization was on August the 5th. After that, when I turned down Oswald's offer, I found him in the street carrying on a rally in favor of Fidel Castro with a big sign in his chest reading Viva Fidel and Hands Off Cuba.
Bringuier realized that Oswald's visit to his store had been a devious piece of pro-Castro subterfuge and that he'd been right not to trust him. Oswald smiled and offered to shake Bringuier's hand, but Bringuier refused the offer. Things soon got heated. Bringuier took off his glasses and put up his fists, but Oswald kept his hands by his side and said, "Okay, Carlos, if you want to hit me, hit me." Bringuier wisely decided not to take the bait. "At that moment," he said later, "he was trying to appear as a martyr if I will hit him, and I decide not to hit him." Before long, the police arrived and broke things up. Oswald was arrested for disturbing the peace, along with Bringuier and a couple of his anti-Castro comrades. Here's Bringuier again.
"At that moment, I had a small fight with him, and I went to jail with him. At the jail, he was really cold blood. He was answering the question that he liked to answer in the way that he liked to answer. He wasn't not a nut or a nervous person, nothing like that. He was an indoctrinated communist."
At the jail, he was really cold-blooded, said Bringuier. He was answering the questions that he liked to answer in the way that he liked to answer. He was not a nut or a nervous person or anything like that. he was an indoctrinated communist. And Brignere picked up another nugget at the jail as well. He found out about Oswald's interesting fake name.
And at the jail, we found out something interesting. The name that he was using on New Orleans at that moment was the name of A.J. Heidel. That was the name that he was using in the literature from the Fair Play for Cuba committee that he was handing out.
Brignere and his friends bailed themselves out, but Oswald spent the night in jail. When he appeared in court a couple of days later, he pled guilty and paid a fine. So let's sum up what Oswald did here. 8 days earlier, he wrote in a letter to the Fair Play for Cuba committee, quote, "Through the efforts of some Cuban exile Osanos, a street demonstration was attacked and we were officially cautioned by the police." At the time, that was a complete lie, but in the space of just 8 days, Oswald had manipulated events so that the lie had come true. The whole episode is actually quite creepy. It shows us how dogged Oswald could be in the pursuit of his fantasies. It shows us that when he put his mind to it, he had the willpower to follow through on those fantasies and convert them into realities. Naturally, he used this incident to generate yet more paperwork for his Cuba file. In a letter that he sent off to the head office of the US Communist Party, he described the whole drama in detail and enclosed a newspaper clipping about it. He also sent an account of the episode to the Fair Play for Cuba Committee headquarters in New York, although of course he made it sound as if this latest street clash was a different street clash from the fictional one that he told them about previously. He enclosed a copy of his court summons as if to remove any doubt that this time the incident really had happened. "I am very glad I am stirring things up and shall continue to do so," Oswald wrote. The incident was given considerable coverage in the press and local TV news broadcast. I'm sure it will be all to the good of the Fair Play for Cuba committee. Once again, the committee didn't dignify that letter with a response. When Oswald made his appearance in court, a cameraman from a local TV station gave him a business card, and he asked Oswald to tip him off next time he staged one of his street protests. The cameraman didn't have long to wait. 4 days later, Oswald told him to come down to the city's International Trade Mart at noon. If the cameraman supplied the camera, Oswald would supply the street protest. That night, footage of Oswald's protest at the Trade Mart was screened on the local TV news. The footage survives, although unfortunately there's no audio. It shows Oswald standing on a windy street corner with two other young men, and they're fairly meekly offering copies of the Hands Off Cuba leaflet to passers-by. Oswald is wearing dark trousers and a short-sleeved white shirt with a dark narrow tie. As for the two young men who were helping him, one of them was a kid named Charles Steele Jr. Oswald had recruited him down at the unemployment office that morning. He'd offered him $2 for 15 minutes' work. The identity of the second young man has never been established. In all probability, he was just another stranger that Oswald recruited at the unemployment office, although if you listen to some people, the mystery of who this second man was has recently been cracked.
His father. I don't know his father. I met him once. I think he's a lovely guy. I think he's a lovely guy. All I did is point out the fact that on the cover of the National Enquirer, there was a picture of him and Crazy Lee Harvey Oswald having breakfast. Now, Ted never denied that it was his father.
That's Donald Trump in 2016. The photograph he was talking about was a still frame from the TV footage of Oswald's street protest. It showed Oswald and the unidentified second young man standing side by side on a street. This image had appeared on the cover of the National Enquirer in May 2016, and the Enquirer had baselessly claimed that the man in the photograph with Oswald was Ted Cruz's father. Trump had recycled that claim in the Republican primaries, even though it was completely without merit. Although we'll probably never know for sure who the man with Oswald was, one thing we can say with certainty is that it wasn't Ted Cruz's father. As for Trump's suggestion that Oswald and this other guy were, quote, "having breakfast" in the photo, I can't even begin to explain where Trump thought he got that detail from. The photo shows two men standing on a street in the middle of the day. There's no food or drink in the frame. There's nothing that even looks like food. The breakfast motif was strictly a product of Trump's imagination. And a man who can hallucinate a detail like that has got no business calling anybody else crazy, not even Lee Harvey Oswald. As baffling as this part of Trump's story was, though, it's actually quite typical of the way the more extreme kind of conspiracy theorists go about their business. They make extraordinary claims about the world, but they're woefully unable to describe basic facts accurately, or perhaps even to perceive them accurately. But to get back to real history, as opposed to the fever dreams of Donald Trump, the real news about August the 16th, 1963, was that Oswald had got himself on TV, and his efforts to make a name for himself as the leading Castro booster in New Orleans were really starting to get some traction. Just a day after his TV debut, Oswald was invited to come down to the local radio station, WDSU, to record an interview for a show called Latin Listening Post.
Tonight we have with us a representative of probably the most controversial organization connected with Cuba in this country. The organization, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. The person, Lee Oswald.
That's Bill Stuckey, the host of Latin Listening Post.
As a reporter of Latin American affairs in this city for several years now, your columnist has kept a lookout for local representatives of this pro-Castro group. None appeared in public view until this week, when young Lee Oswald was arrested and convicted for disturbing the peace. He was arrested while passing out pro-Castro literature to a crowd which included several violently anti-Castro Cuban refugees. When we finally tracked Mr. Oswald down today and asked him to participate in Latin Listening Post, he told us frankly that he would because it may help his organization attract more members in this area. Mr. Oswald, how long has the Fair Play for Cuba Committee had an organization in New Orleans?
We have had members in this area for several months now. Up until about 2 months ago, however, we have not organized our members into any sort of an active group. Until, as you say, this week, we have decided to feel out the public, and for that purpose we have been, as you say, distributing literature on the street.
Oswald's conversation with Bill Stuckey lasted for half an hour, and it's full of fascinating details about what Oswald believed politically. As their interview went on, Bill Stuckey gradually turned the heat up on Oswald. When it came to Cuba, Stuckey knew his stuff, and he seemed to detect that Oswald perhaps didn't. He pressed him about his credentials to talk about Cuba, given that Oswald had never even been there.
Mr. Oswald, when was the last time you were in Latin America?
I've been only to Mexico in my life, sir. I'm not fully acquainted with Latin America personally, but then I'm not the president of this organization either. I'm merely a volunteer, a secretary of this local chapter. And one does not have to travel through Central and South America. One does not have to see the poverty in Chile or Peru or the suppression of democratic liberties by the Samoa brothers in Nicaragua in order to draw one's conclusion about Cuba.
Oswald meant the Somoza brothers, not the Samoa brothers. As it happened, Bill Stuckey also knew a thing or two about Nicaragua, so he was able to note that there was a key difference between that country and Cuba.
Very interesting that you should mention dictatorships in Nicaragua, because it's curious to me as to why no Nicaraguans fled to the United States last year, whereas we had possibly 50 to 60,000 Cubans fleeing from Cuba to the United States. Yes. What is the Fair Play for Cuba Committee's official reply to this?
Well, a good question. Nicaraguan situation is one considerably different from Castro's Cuba. People are not inclined to flee their countries unless some new system, some new factor enters into their lives. I must say that very surely into the Nicaragua, no new factors have entered for about 300 years. And so because of the fact that no new factor has entered into their lives, because of the fact that no liberating factor has entered into their lives, they remain in Nicaragua.
Let's stop Oswald there for a moment, because what he just said is worth lingering on, given that we're trying to work out what made him tick politically. He said that the reason why no Nicaraguans were currently fleeing Nicaragua, while Cubans were fleeing Cuba in their tens of thousands, is that people flee their countries only when some new factor, some liberating factor, has entered into their lives. As I've said, there's one school of conspiracy theory that's always insisted that Oswald was only pretending to be a left-winger. There are plenty of reasons to believe that that's nonsense, but one reason is that no fake left-winger, no matter how good he was at pretending, could possibly have come up on the spot with a concept as delicious as the liberating factor that causes people to flee their country in their tens of thousands. To come out with stuff like that on the fly, you had to have spent years marinating yourself in communist propaganda, as Oswald had. You had to be steeped in an ideology whose basic job was to defend the indefensible. George Orwell wrote that political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable. On the radio in New Orleans, Oswald showed that he was a natural master of using hard-left euphemisms to get himself out of tight spots. Anyone who thinks Oswald was faking it should check out the full 30-minute recording of this radio appearance and listen to him go. To sound as confident as he sounds while you're talking pure tripe, you have to be a true believer. You have to believe that your cause is so correct that it automatically justifies anything you do in the name of it, up to and including murder. As their interview went on, Bill Stuckey kept peppering Oswald with facts that seemed unanswerable, and yet Oswald had answers for all of them, because his crude and ruthless ideology gave him an answer for everything.
Now, the people who have fled Cuba, that is an interesting situation. Needless to say, there are classes of criminals, there are classes of people who are wanted in Cuba for crimes against humanity. Those are the people who would certainly not want to go back to Cuba and who would certainly want to flee Cuba. There are other classes. There are peasants who do not like the collectivization in Cuban agriculture. There are others who, for one reason or another, more or less legitimate reasons, reasons of opinion, have fled Cuba. And I think that the opinion and the attitude of the Cuban government to this is good riddance.
Yes, Oswald did just say good riddance to the tens of thousands of Cubans who had felt the need to flee Castro's revolution on the nearest raft or rubber tire. We shouldn't forget here that in Oswald's fantasies, Castro himself was one day going to get wind of all these wonderful things that Oswald was saying about him in New Orleans. And if Castro had heard Oswald in action on WDSU, he surely would have found him to be a delightfully shameless ally, maybe even a bit too shameless at times. Bill Stuckey didn't pick Oswald up on his use of the phrase good riddance because he had other things to pick him up on. For instance, he took issue with Oswald's claim that a good chunk of the people fleeing Cuba were criminals or representatives of the former Batista regime.
Mr. Oswald, that's very interesting. Because as a reporter in this field for some time, I've been interviewing refugees for now about 3 years. And I'd say that the last Batista man officially that I talked to left Cuba about 2.5 years ago. The rest of them that I've talked to have been taxicab drivers, day laborers, cane cutters, and that sort of thing. I thought this revolution was supposed to benefit these people. What is the Fair Play for Cuba's position on this?
You say the revolution is supposed to benefit these people. You know, it's very funny about revolutions. Revolutions require work. Revolutions require a certain amount of sacrifice, sacrificing one's old personal ideas about country, citizenship, work. And these people who have fled Cuba have not been able to adapt themselves to these new factors which have entered into their lives. These people are the uneducated. These people are the people who did not remain in Cuba to be educated by young people who were afraid of the alphabet, who were afraid that they would lose something by collectivization. These are people who have not been able to adapt.
In the early 1950s, when the population of East Germany rose up in protest against that country's useless and authoritarian communist regime, the poet Bertolt Brecht joked that maybe it was time for the government to dissolve the people and elect a new one. That was pretty much Oswald's position on Cuba, although he wasn't trying to be funny. The people fleeing the place in droves were just lazy, and they didn't know what was good for them. They were people, but they clearly weren't the people. They were ill-educated peasants, or scum, as Oswald implies, but doesn't quite say. You might think I'm going off on a tangent here. You might think that Oswald's specific views about the Cuban Revolution don't have anything to do with the assassination of Kennedy. But I'd say they've got a lot to do with the assassination of Kennedy, because a man who could so glibly justify this mass exodus from Cuba as a political necessity obviously wasn't going to have much difficulty convincing himself when the time came that the assassination of President Kennedy was a political necessity too. The skeptics say that Oswald can't have been a true communist because a true communist would have known that murdering Kennedy wouldn't do the cause of world communism any good and would in fact cause a lot of innocent communists to be persecuted. But that argument is based on an extremely shallow definition of what belief is and how it works. A true believer doesn't always act rationally in the objective best interests of his cause, especially when the true believer happens to be a psychopath. Oswald was a supremely self-centered individual, and the first question we need to ask about his political ideology is the first question that he unconsciously asked himself about anything or person. What purpose did it serve for him? And if you listen to this interview, you can see that his radical ideology served a very deep purpose for him indeed. Effectively, it was his religion. It was his way of orienting himself in a confusing world. It was the framework that let him understand any new situation immediately, at a stroke. His way of having an instant answer to any question. His way of demonstrating that he was superior to everybody around him. And it was also his way of assuring himself that his homicidal urges made him a good person rather than a bad one. Oswald badly needed a belief system that assured him that it was okay, and in fact quite progressive, to hate the world and go around shooting people. He needed a belief system that gave him an end that would justify any means. So you can see why he identified so strongly with Fidel Castro, who showed that you could be revered internationally as a man of the people, despite the fact that you treated actual people very badly. Oswald's hero worship of Castro was his way of justifying to himself all the tyrannical things that he'd done in his own life, and the even worse things he would do if he got a chance. Of course, compared with Castro, Oswald was still a low achiever. He was just a petty domestic tyrant who hadn't committed any acts of revolutionary violence except for one attempted murder, at least so far. Bill Stuckey's interview with Oswald went to air on WDSU on the evening of Saturday, August the 17th. It made quite a splash, and again it led on to bigger and better things. The following Wednesday night, Oswald was invited to return to the WDSU studios to take part in a live debate against two prominent local anti-communists. One of them was none other than Carlos Bringier, who was itching to tell the world the story of Oswald's sneaky attempt to infiltrate the Cuban Student Directorate. The debate would be moderated by Bill Stuckey, along with another WDSU host named Bill Slatter.
It's time now for Conversation Carte Blanche. Here is Bill Slatter.
Good evening. For the next few minutes, Bill Stuckey and I are going to be talking with three gentlemen, the subject mainly revolving around Cuba. Our guests tonight are Lee Harvey Oswald, who is secretary of the New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Our second guest is Ed Butler, who is executive director of the Information Council of the Americas. And our third guest is Carlos Bringier, a Cuban refugee and New Orleans delegate of the Revolutionary Student Directorate, one of the more active of the anti-Castro refugee organizations.
If you're thinking that it sounds like Oswald was going to be seriously outnumbered in this debate, you're right. The next 20 minutes were going to be a fiasco for Oswald. In fact, this was the night when his career as Castro's leading hype man in New Orleans was finally going to implode.
Bill, at this time, if you'll briefly background the situation as you know it.
Thank you, Bill.
I believe that I was probably the first New Orleans reporter to interview Mr. Oswald on his activities here since he first came into public view. There were a few items, apparently, that I suspect that Mr. Oswald left out of this original interview, which was principally where he lived after between 1959 and 1962.
This is where things began going south for Oswald. Since speaking with Oswald earlier in the week, Bill Stuckey had found out the truth about Oswald's political past, and Stuckey didn't appreciate the way Oswald had effectively lied to him about it in their first interview. So he'd prepared a kind of ambush for Oswald. He'd brought along some old newspaper reports about Oswald's defection to the Soviet Union, and he was about to confront him with them live on the air.
Mr. Butler brought some newspaper clippings to my attention, and I also found some through an independent investigation, Washington newspaper clippings, to the effect that Mr. Oswald had attempted to renounce his American citizenship in 1959 and become a Soviet citizen. There was another clipping dated 1952 saying that Mr. Oswald had returned from the Soviet Union with his wife and child after having lived there for 3 years. Mr. Oswald, are these correct?
That is correct, yes.
You did live in Russia for 3 years?
That is correct, and I think those the fact that I did live for a time in the Soviet Union gives me excellent qualifications to repudiate charges that Cuba and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee is communist-controlled.
You've got to admire how fast Oswald was able to think on his feet there. This was a moment straight out of his worst nightmares. His past had finally caught up with him, and it was happening live on the air. He'd handled that first salvo pretty well, but the nightmare was far from over. A moment later, Carlos Bringier joined the pylon. He told Oswald that he was confused. Was the name of the organization he represented the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, or was it the Fair Play for Russia Committee?
Well, that is, of course, a very provocative and question. I don't think it requires an answer.
Then Bill Slatter threw another curveball at Oswald.
How many people do you have in your committee here in New Orleans?
I cannot reveal that as secretary of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
Is it a secret society?
No, Mr. Butler, it is not. However, it is a standard operating procedure for a political organization consisting of a political minority to safeguard the names and the number of its members.
Ed Butler had joined the fray now, so it was pretty much four against one, and Oswald was being bombarded with questions he either couldn't answer or didn't want to.
Who is the honorary chairman of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee?
The honorary chairman of this committee, the name of that person, I certainly don't know.
Well, let me tell you, in case you don't know about your own organization.
No, I know about it.
His name is Waldo Frank.
Oswald was audibly on the ropes at this point. He was stuck in a situation he couldn't control. The curly questions were coming at him from every angle.
Mr. Oswald, I may break in a moment. I believe it was mentioned that you at one time asked to renounce your American citizenship and become a citizen of the Soviet Union. Is that correct?
Well, I don't think that has a particular import to this discussion. We are discussing Cuban-American relations.
Well, I think it has a bearing to this extent, Mr. Oswald. You say, apparently, that Cuba is not dominated by Russia, and yet you apparently, by your own past actions, have shown that you have an affinity for Russia and perhaps communism, although I don't know that you admit that you either are a communist or have been. Could you straighten out that point? Are you or have you been a communist?
Well, I had answered that prior to this program on another radio program.
Are you a Marxist?
Yes, I am a Marxist.
Oswald's carefully constructed secret life was coming apart at the seams. He must have been in a world of pain now. He must have been wondering how many more of his secrets these people knew.
Now, I'm curious to know just how you supported yourself during the 3 years that you lived in the Soviet Union. Did you have a government subsidy?
I will answer that question directly then, since you will not rest until you get your answer. I worked in Russia. I was under the protection of I was not under the protection of the American government, but that is, I was at all times considered an American citizen. I did not lose my American citizenship.
Did you say you wanted to at one point, though, or what happened?
Well, it's a long, drawn-out situation in which permission to live in the Soviet Union granted to a foreign resident is very rarely given. At no time, as I say, did I renounce my citizenship or attempt to renounce my citizenship.
Again, you have to hand it to Oswald there. For a man who's been ambushed on live radio, he's actually doing fairly well. He's not telling the entire truth, but he's giving a pretty decent impression of a man who is. We have to remind ourselves here that Oswald was just 23 years old. He was a self-educated high school dropout, and here he was on the radio facing four guys who were all better educated and better connected than he was. If Oswald was a different kind of person, he might have responded by stalking out of the studio or curling up under the desk in the fetal position. But as Carlos Bringier had noticed on an earlier occasion, Oswald had the ability to be really cold-blooded when he was put into a corner. That's one reason why I've been playing so much audio from this debate. There are people who'll tell you that Oswald can't possibly have assassinated Kennedy because he didn't appear panicked or flustered afterwards. When Officer Marion Baker encountered Oswald on the second floor of the book depository about 90 seconds after Kennedy was shot, Oswald didn't seem to be out of breath. He appeared normal and calm, Baker said. And later that night, when he was paraded in front of the cameras in handcuffs, Oswald didn't look all that perturbed. If anything, he looked a bit too relaxed, given the situation he was in. But Oswald functioned very well under pressure, and the radio debate gives us real-time evidence of that. Even when he was clearly in the wrong and had been caught telling a major lie, Oswald still had remarkable self-possession and self-belief. Towards the end of the debate, Ed Butler seemed to have Oswald on the ropes again. He whipped out an old newspaper report that seemed to prove beyond any doubt that Oswald had tried to renounce his American citizenship in Moscow, despite what he was saying now. But Oswald burned Butler with a comeback that sounded very plausible.
Excuse me, may I interrupt just 1 second? The Washington Evening Star of October 31st, 1959, page 1, reported that Lee Harvey Oswald, a former Marine, had turned in his passport at the American Embassy in Moscow on that same date and had said that he had applied for Soviet citizenship. Now, this seems to me that you've renounced your American citizenship if you've turned in your passport.
Well, the very obvious answer to that is that I'm back in the United States. A person who renounces his citizenship becomes legally disqualified for returning to the United States.
As cocky as Oswald's tone is there, though, he is talking bollocks. The fact is that he had turned in his passport at the American Embassy in Moscow and had tried to renounce his citizenship. The only reason he was back in the United States now was that the staff at the embassy had had the decency not to let him have his way because they correctly guessed that one day he was going to change his mind. By now, the radio debate was starting to wind down. The fireworks were mostly over. But about a minute before the hosts wrapped things up, one last interesting thing happened. Carlos Bringier asked Oswald a question about President Kennedy. He pointed out that in a recent speech, Fidel Castro had called Kennedy a ruffian and a thief. Bringier challenged Oswald to say whether he agreed or disagreed with that characterization of his president. Here is their exchange.
Do you agree with Fidel Castro when he, in his last speech, he qualified President John Fitzgerald Kennedy of the United States as a ruffian and a thief?
I would not agree with that particular wording. However, I and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee does think that the United States government, through certain agencies, namely the State Department and the CIA has made monumental mistakes in its relations with Cuba.
That was pretty ballsy stuff from Oswald, and it certainly puts the lie to the suggestion that he never had any political gripe against Kennedy. The unelected head of a hostile foreign power had called the American president a ruffian and a thief, and Oswald, in a public forum, couldn't bring himself to say that that was out of line. The most that he would say is that he didn't agree with that particular wording. We need to put a pin in this exchange between Brigier and Oswald, because as we'll see, Fidel Castro had quite a habit of trash-talking Kennedy in the press. And shortly before the president's assassination, Castro said something even more inflammatory about him, something that sounded quite a bit like a death threat, in fact. And there are some commentators who think that Oswald was heavily influenced by what Castro said and might well have had his words in mind when he gunned Kennedy down. But that wouldn't happen for a while yet. On the night of the radio debate, Oswald left the WDSU studios in a dejected state. The secret of his Soviet past was out now, and he was realistic enough to fear that his career as Castro's leading PR man in New Orleans was probably over. And in fact, it was. Oswald wouldn't appear in front of another camera or microphone until the night of Kennedy's death. A week after the WDSU debacle, he sent off a forlorn letter to the Central Committee of the US Communist Party. "Comrades," he wrote, "please advise me on a question of personal tactics." He explained what had happened in the radio studio, and he went on, "Having come back to the US in 1962 and thrown myself into the struggle for progress and freedom in the United States, I would like to know whether, in your opinion, I can continue to fight. Handicapped, as it were, by my past record, can I still, under the circumstances, compete with anti-progressive forces above ground, or whether, in your opinion, I should always remain in the background, i.e. underground?" Almost certainly, Oswald had no intention of following the comrade's advice on this question, but he made a characteristically large song and dance about asking for it. "But what do you think I should do?" he went on. "Which do you think is the best tactic in general? Should I dissociate myself from all progressive activities? I fear I may have compromised the FPCC, so you see that I need the advice of trusted, long-time fighters for progress. Please advise. With fraternal greeting, Lee H. Oswald." When Oswald's letter was opened at Communist Party HQ, the comrades sensed that Oswald was a, quote, nut, who was very possibly working on behalf of the FBI. So it was a month before the party's information director wrote back to Oswald, and when his letter finally arrived, his advice was offensively brief and non-committal. "You have a right to participate in such organizations as you want," he wrote, "but often it is advisable for some people to remain in the background, not underground." By the time the letter reached him, Oswald was less than a week away from leaving New Orleans for Mexico City, so he was far too preoccupied now to be wounded by the comrade's chilly reply from New York, much less to heed their advice to remain in the background. And he'd pretty much stopped collecting paperwork for the file that he would be taking there with him. Now that his career as a pro-Castro activist had been blown, that file was as complete as it was ever going to get. And Oswald seems to have been fairly confident that there was enough in it to put him over the top down in Mexico. This is where we come to that threatening-sounding public remark that Fidel Castro made about President Kennedy. On September the 9th, 2 weeks before Oswald left New Orleans for Mexico City, Castro was interviewed in Havana by a reporter from UPI. In the course of that interview, Castro called Kennedy a cheap and crooked politician, and he added, "We are prepared to fight them and answer in kind. United States leaders should think that if they are aiding terrorists' plans to eliminate Cuban leaders, they themselves will not be safe." This sinister-sounding threat or promise was widely reported in America, as Castro had known it would be. And when Kennedy was murdered just 2 months later, Castro's words seemed to take on a new significance. So what was Castro thinking when he said that? And was it just an accident that Kennedy died so soon afterwards? Even if you don't put Kennedy's death into the equation, Castro's remark would seem to have been dangerously hot-headed and irresponsible at the very best. But we now know that Castro had in fact chosen his words with great care, and there was a lot more to this story than met the eye at the time. Back in 1960, the CIA had launched a covert operation codenamed Operation Mongoose, whose aim was to get rid of Fidel Castro by any means necessary. The CIA had canvassed a number of grossly illegal plans to assassinate Castro. One of them involved putting poison on his cigars. Another involved planting fake exploding coral in locations where Castro went skin diving. And a third and more plausible option involved contracting his murder out to members of the American Mafia, who had a beef with Castro because he'd shut down their lucrative Cuban casinos. The American public didn't find out about Operation Mongoose until the 1970s, when a congressional committee forced the CIA to spill the beans. But agents of the Castro regime had penetrated the operation in real time, so Castro knew what the CIA was up to as early as 1963. This explains why he told that reporter in Havana that, quote, "United States leaders should think that if they are aiding terrorists' plans to eliminate Cuban leaders, they themselves will not be safe." Castro wasn't being hot-headed when he said that. He was sending a coded warning to Kennedy and the CIA. "I know about your plans to assassinate me, and if you don't lay off them, maybe I'll send someone to assassinate you." When Kennedy really was assassinated just a couple of months later, Castro's public threat took on a very bad smell, and he had to do a lot of public backpedaling. He had to stress that despite his rhetoric, he hadn't really wanted to see Kennedy die. Here he is in 1978, speaking through a very sexy-sounding translator.
¿Por qué? Porque nosotros no creemos que son los hombres.
Why? Because we do not believe that the system is abolished by liquidating the leaders. It is the system that we opposed, the reactionary ideas, not the men. Our reaction to the assassination was one of grief, because it seemed to us a painful, tragic way for Kennedy's life to end.
The evidence suggests that Castro was basically telling the truth there. A French journalist happened to be in the room with Castro when he heard that Kennedy had been shot, and he reported that Castro was far from happy to hear the news. "This is bad news," he said. "At least Kennedy was an enemy to whom we'd become accustomed." And over the years, no conclusive evidence has emerged that the Castro regime had any direct involvement in Kennedy's assassination. I'm choosing my adjectives carefully there, though. I said that there has never been any conclusive evidence of any direct Cuban involvement, but there is some evidence that when Oswald visited the Cuban embassy in Mexico, 2 weeks after Castro made his aggressive public remarks about the president, Oswald may have said something to the staff there about the desirability of shooting Kennedy. That evidence may not be conclusive, but it can't be dismissed lightly. And if we believe it, it means that some Cuban officials, even if they didn't order or encourage Oswald to do what he did know in advance that he was at least vaguely thinking of doing it. There's also some credible evidence that Oswald may have mentioned the idea of shooting Kennedy to some anti-Castro Cubans while he was making another shady attempt to infiltrate a Cuban exile group. I'm not going to open either of those cans of worms now. I'll be coming back to the more complicated aspects of the Cuba story in a future episode. But I will say this. All the best writers I've read on this case agree on one thing. If there was any whiff of a real conspiracy in Kennedy's murder, that conspiracy had to do with Cuba. If Oswald told anybody in advance that Kennedy ought to be shot and that he was thinking of doing it himself, the people he said that to were Cubans, from one extreme of Cuban politics or the other. Even if Oswald didn't say anything to the Cubans in Mexico it's still possible to argue that Castro was implicated in the assassination in a roundabout way. Castro's threatening remarks about Kennedy were reported in the New Orleans newspapers on September the 9th, 1963, and it's highly likely that Oswald read those reports. Oswald had no way of knowing about the subtext of Castro's threat, so he would have taken it at face value, and it might well have made him believe that if he shot Kennedy, he would be carrying out the wishes of his hero Fidel. There are some intelligent commentators who think that's the way things happened. For example, the American lawyer David Bellin wrote in his book Final Disclosure, "What better way for recognition in Cuba could there be than to kill the person, Kennedy, who was allegedly responsible for attempts to kill Castro?" I like Bellin's work, and his observations about the Kennedy assassination are generally worth listening to. In fact, I'll be quoting him again before the end of this episode. But on this particular point, I think there's an obvious common sense objection to what Bellin says. When Castro's threatening remarks about Kennedy were reported in the American newspapers, Oswald was just 2 weeks shy of trying to get into Cuba via Mexico. If that plan had worked out, he seems to have had no intention of ever returning to the US. So it seems highly unlikely that the idea of killing Kennedy would seriously have crossed Oswald's mind at this point. It may have crossed his mind as a vague whim, but not as a serious plan. As I've said before, I don't think Oswald had any serious intention of killing Kennedy until November the 19th or 20th, a few days before the assassination, when he found out that Kennedy's motorcade would be coming past the book depository. That was the day when Oswald finally had the means, motive, and opportunity to kill Kennedy. It was the day that all three cherries on the fruit machine lined up. He'd had the means since March, when he took delivery of the high-powered rifle that he originally planned to shoot General Walker with. The opportunity didn't click into place until Oswald read about the motorcade route. And if you ask me, it was only then, when he knew that he would have this very real opportunity, that Oswald's motive finally crystallized. Suddenly, all of his private resentments and revolutionary fantasies would have a chance to discharge themselves against the lightning rod of this fantastic opportunity. There's no need to believe that Oswald had any burning desire to kill Kennedy before then, and in fact, if you believe that Oswald started seriously wanting to kill Kennedy back in September, before he even made his trip to Mexico, you have to believe that he then benefited from a couple of truly massive coincidences. You have to believe that on October the 16th, he just so happened to land a job in a building that just so happened to turn out a month later to be located on the route that the man he was itching to murder would be taking through Dallas. I find it impossible to believe things happened that way, so that's why I don't buy the idea that Oswald's plan to kill Kennedy dated back to the remarks Castro made about him in September. I do think it's fair, though, to suspect that those remarks planted the seed in Oswald, one of many seeds that germinated when he heard that Kennedy's limousine would be coming past the book depository. Up to now, my discussion of Oswald's motive has focused on the things he said and did in the months and weeks leading up to Kennedy's murder. But now that we've arrived at the day of the assassination itself, I want to pivot and look at the motive question from the opposite angle. What can we learn about Oswald's motives by looking at the things that he said and did after committing the crime? Let's start by asking a simple question. If Oswald hadn't been arrested in the Texas theater that afternoon, what would he have done next? Where was he on his way to? Conspiracy theorists have asked all sorts of fanciful and useless questions about this case over the years. Generally, they're questions that have been already answered 100 times in ways the conspiracy theorists don't like. But the question of what Oswald planned to do after the assassination is a genuinely pertinent question that hasn't been asked or answered nearly often enough. We know what he did do after the assassination, of course. He went back to his apartment, he got his pistol, he was stopped on the street by Officer J.D. Tippett, he shot Tippett dead, he ran and hid in the Texas theater, and he was arrested there by police officers, one of whom he did his best to shoot. But why did Oswald do those things? Were they part of some larger plan? When J.D. Tippett saw Oswald walking along 10th Street in Oak Cliff and started tailing him in his squad car, where was Oswald going? He was certainly going somewhere. So if Tippett had never seen him, where would he have ended up? And if Johnny Brewer hadn't seen him slip into the Texas Theatre 20 minutes after the Tippett shooting, and if Brewer hadn't got the box office attendant to call the police, where would Oswald have gone when the movie was over? It's possible, of course, that those questions are meaningless. Maybe Oswald had no clear idea of what he intended to do after shooting Kennedy. Maybe his plan was complete when he inflicted the headshot. Maybe he never thought beyond that. Maybe everything he did afterwards was just him going into rat survival mode. And even if he did have a clear plan in his head, we'll never be able to know for sure what that was. All we can do is speculate. But speculation isn't necessarily a useless activity. It can be quite fruitful if you do it on the basis of the known facts. And we do have a few solid facts to go on, if we want to think realistically about where Oswald might have been headed that afternoon. We know that he had a smallish sum of cash on him when he was arrested, $13.87, which in today's money would be about $135. That morning when he left for work, Oswald told Marina that he'd left her some cash on the bureau, and she was surprised to find that what he'd left her there was basically all their life savings, $170, which is the equivalent of $1,600 today. So if Oswald did have a clear exit strategy in mind, it was something that he thought he could cover with about $135 in today's money, which wasn't much, but wasn't nothing either. Another thing Oswald had in his pocket was a bus transfer ticket. Remember that he jumped on a bus straight after the assassination, then jumped off again when the bus got stuck in traffic, and went and got a taxi home instead. But as he got off the bus, Oswald asked the driver for a transfer ticket. Given that he was in the biggest hurry he'd ever been in his life, it does seem significant that Oswald paused to ask the driver for that transfer ticket. It seems that he must have had a fairly clear sense that he would be needing it. And when it was found on him at the time of his arrest, the transfer ticket was still valid for some bus routes. Speaking of Oswald and buses, here's another clue about his possible intentions after the assassination.
And the door opened, he come in a hurry. Now, who are you in a hurry? He never reported his lip, went to his room, got a short coat put on, and went out and to the bus stop. And that's the last I saw of him.
That's Oswald's housekeeper, Earlene Roberts, describing the lightning pit stop that Oswald made at his rooming house half an hour after the assassination. He got a short coat and put it on and went out to the bus stop, and that's the last I saw of him, Mrs. Roberts says. The bus stop she was talking about was right outside the rooming house, and it was visible through the front window. The last time Mrs. Roberts saw Oswald, he appeared to be waiting at that bus stop. When she looked again a moment later, he was gone, even though no bus had come by. So if Oswald flirted with the idea of waiting for a bus there, he changed his mind about that pretty fast. The next sighting of Oswald came around 8 minutes later, 9/10 of a mile away, when Helen Markham saw him walking down 10th Street with J.D. Tippett's patrol car on his tail. As some of the more lucid writers about this case have pointed out, when Oswald had his fatal encounter with Tippett, he was just 4 blocks shy of a bus transfer point where he could have used the ticket in his pocket to take a bus back to downtown Dallas. In 1970, a guy named Albert Newman published an interesting book called The Assassination of John F. Kennedy, The Reasons Why. Newman's big idea was that even after the assassination of President Kennedy, Oswald still hadn't given up on his plan to shoot General Walker. Newman believed that Oswald, who was of course now armed with his pistol, was planning to catch a bus from the transfer point to the Dallas interchange, where he would board another bus headed for Walker's neighborhood. According to Newman's theory, Oswald planned to shoot Walker and then surrender, having chalked up two political assassinations in one afternoon. Mind you, Walker wasn't in Dallas that day, so if that was Oswald's plan, it wouldn't have ended up coming off, as Newman himself concedes. I don't happen to find Newman's theory all that convincing, but one thing you can say for it is that it can't be proved wrong, because unlike so many other writers about this case, Newman accepts all the solid evidence about what happened and who Oswald was, and he uses reasonable guesswork to fill in the parts of the picture that are still missing. A more persuasive theory about Oswald's plans for the rest of that afternoon was put forward by David Billen in the two books that he wrote about this case, Final Disclosure and another one called November 22nd, 1963. Billen suspected that even after the assassination, Oswald might still have had some hope of fleeing to Cuba via Mexico. He points out that Oswald shot Tippett at 1:12 p.m. and at 1:40 p.m. a bus headed for downtown Dallas was due at that transfer point 4 blocks away. If Oswald had caught that bus, he then could have caught a 3:15 p.m. Greyhound bus from Dallas to the border town of Laredo, Texas. At Laredo, Oswald would have had to wait another 30 minutes to connect with another bus that would take him over the Mexican border. According to Bellin's sums, the $13.87 in Oswald's pocket would have been just enough to cover both those bus rides. Bellin also had a backup theory, which actually strikes me as the best theory of all about Oswald's destination that afternoon. He points out that another bus Oswald could have taken from the transfer point would have been able to drop him off within walking distance of two private airports in southern Dallas. The idea of hijacking a plane to Cuba had certainly occurred to Oswald before, so Billen wonders if it maybe occurred to him again now. Maybe that's the reason why he'd grabbed his loaded pistol from the rooming house. Billen is an honest writer, so he's careful to say that both of his theories about Oswald's intentions that day are pure speculation. But again, this is the good kind of speculation. It doesn't twist or ignore the established facts, and it's informed by a realistic sense of who Oswald was. Anyway, if Oswald had any sort of exit strategy that involved catching a bus from the transfer point that he'd almost arrived at when Tippett stopped him, that plan obviously hit the wall the moment that he gunned Tippett down. After that happened, he could hardly afford to stand around waiting for 30 minutes at a bus stop 4 blocks away from the crime scene. He had to get off the street as soon as possible.
And now, if we may return to an angle concerning Harvey Lee Oswald, who has been arrested, who has been charged with the murder of a Dallas policeman and will be charged by word of the district attorney in Dallas with the murder of President Kennedy. The man has a fascinating record. We've heard a great deal of it about how he was a Marine, went to Russia, wanted to become a citizen in 1957, returned to the United States in 1959. He was an admirer of Fidel Castro and all of that.
That's a radio reporter on the night of Kennedy's assassination, getting Oswald's name wrong and scrambling to find answers to the question that was on everyone's mind. Who was this man who was about to be charged with the president's murder, and why had he done what he'd done? During his interrogations at City Hall, Oswald himself had already dropped some interesting clues about that. Some of those clues were quite meaty, and they've been hiding in plain sight for 60 years. At one point, Captain Fritz of the Dallas Police Department asked Oswald what he thought of President Kennedy, and here's what Oswald said in reply, according to the notes of a Secret Service agent who was there. "I have no views on the president. My wife and I like the president's family. They're interesting people. I have my own views on the president's national policy. I have a right to express my views, but because of the charges, I do not think I should comment further." So Oswald freely admitted that, given that he'd been charged with the president's murder, now wasn't a good time to go into his views about the man's national policy. He wasn't conceding that he was guilty, but he was conceding that his political views would, at least in theory, have given him a clear motive to assassinate the president. Over the years, conspiracy theorists have tied themselves into all sorts of knots trying to deny this elementary point, so it's interesting to note that Oswald himself conceded it straight off the bat. And here's another whopping clue that Oswald dropped that day about his motivations. As he was being escorted through a corridor at City Hall, he raised his cuffed wrists and gave the press a defiant clenched fist salute. The clenched fist was a standard expression of solidarity among American leftists, and indeed among revolutionaries the world over. Its origins went back to the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s. When Oswald defiantly raised his fist, a photographer named Bill Winfrey caught the moment on camera. You can look at his photograph online, and you can decide for yourself what it says about Oswald's guilt or innocence, and what it says about his motive if he was guilty. Apparently there are some people who can look at that photo and still believe that Oswald was innocent, but it's beyond me how they can think that anybody who'd been falsely accused of murdering the president would want to make that gesture and would look so self-satisfied while he was making it. If you ask me, Oswald's clenched fist wasn't just tantamount to a confession of guilt, it was also a fairly shameless attempt to advertise his pseudo-progressive motive. Mind you, he still wasn't ready to acknowledge his guilt or his motive verbally. In fact, Oswald's whole position at this point was very inconsistent. While his fist was giving a defiant power to the people's salute, his mouth was telling the press that he emphatically denied these charges. And while he admitted nothing to the cops directly, when they asked him if he wanted an attorney, Oswald said, "I want that attorney in New York, Mr. Abt." The man Oswald was talking about was John Abt, spelt A-B-T. Abt was the general counsel of the Communist Party of the United States. "I don't know him personally," Oswald said, "but I know about a case that he handled some years ago when he represented people who had violated the Smith Act. I don't know him personally, but that is the attorney I want." The Smith Act had been passed by Congress in 1940, and it made it a criminal offence for American citizens to advocate the violent overthrow of their government. The Smith Act had often been used to prosecute members of the American Communist Party, and several of those people had been defended by John Abt. Abt was a member of the Communist Party himself, although he kept his membership a secret because he'd been working for the American government at the time he joined up. Oswald never did succeed in getting hold of John Abt, who was away on vacation at the time, but his attempt to secure Abt's services gives us yet another clue about how Oswald framed Kennedy's murder in his own mind. Abt was a political lawyer. He wasn't the kind of attorney you called when you'd been accused of shooting someone you hadn't actually shot. He was the kind of guy you called if you were being persecuted for your beliefs, or if you wanted to become a left-wing cause celeb. Of course, once again, we'll never be able to know for sure what Oswald was thinking at this point, because whatever his intentions were, he never got a chance to follow through on them. His ideal post-assassination experience had already been blindsided by his encounter with J.D. Tippit, and in 2 days' time it was going to be totaled by his encounter with Jack Ruby. But again, it's worth wondering how things would have played out if that unexpected thing hadn't happened. Oswald must have had some vision of his future in mind at this point. So what was it? Now that the eyes of the world were on him, how did he intend to spin and exploit the situation that he'd put himself in? Again, there are some clues that can help us guess what might have been on Oswald's mind at this point. For one thing, we know that his whole interest in radical politics had begun when he was handed a pamphlet about the Rosenbergs at the age of 13. At the time, the international left was waging a massive campaign to save the Rosenbergs from being executed. Some of the Rosenbergs' supporters merely believed that they hadn't received a fair trial, which was possibly true, but a lot of people believed that they were completely innocent and had been stitched up just because they were communists. When Oswald asked to be put in touch with John Abt, he seemed to be gearing up to star in a big political trial that would make other people see him the way he'd seen the Rosenbergs, a trial at which he would either deny his guilt altogether, or else try to defend his crime on political grounds, or maybe even a bit of both, as he was effectively doing already. And it's a fair bet that Fidel Castro was also on Oswald's mind here. In 1953, Castro had failed in his first attempt to mount a Cuban revolution, and the Batista dictatorship had put him on trial. At his sentencing hearing, Castro gave a 4-hour-long speech that was later published in book form under the title History Will Absolve Me. As far as people like Oswald were concerned, history already had absolved Castro, and Oswald might have fancied that history would absolve him too if he had a big public trial where he made speeches like the one Castro had made at his trial. In his book Oswald's Tale, Norman Mailer picks up this idea that Oswald wanted his own heroic trial, and he uses his skills as an imaginative writer to run with that idea. He wonders if Oswald was thinking about his trial even as he fled the book depository. Indeed, writes Mailer, it may even have been the thought of his trial that fired him on. What a podium! Such a trial could alter history, stimulate the stupid, rouse the lethargic, confound the powerful. So he had to feel divided between his desire to escape and his recognition that capture, trial, and incarceration might generate a vastly larger destiny. I think Mailer is very astute there to suggest that even as Oswald fled the crime scene, he probably felt divided between a desire to escape and an equally strong desire to get caught and say his piece. Any nuanced account of Oswald's behaviour after the assassination does have to take note of how inconsistent that behaviour was. As hard as he tried to evade capture, he also can't possibly have believed that he was really going to get away. And when he was caught, he didn't seem all that put out. Once he was in custody, he both denied his guilt vehemently and seemed to be laying the groundwork for a trial where he would defend his crime as a justifiable revolutionary act. Anyway, if Mailer was right to think that Oswald was fantasizing about an heroic trial even as he fled the crime scene, his fantasies were about to trip over a huge stumbling block in the form of Officer J.D. Tippit. To quote Mailer again, "The first element in the loss of an heroic trial became the 4 shots that he fired into Tippit. He knew Americans well enough to recognize that some might listen to his ideas if he killed a president, but nearly all would be repelled by any gunman who would mow down a cop, a family man. That act was small enough to void interest in every large idea he wished to introduce. By killing Tippit, he had wrecked his grand plan to be one of the oracles of history." You could say that all that is just wild speculation on Mailer's part, but Oswald himself made at least one remark that fits right in with Mailer's theory, even though Mailer himself didn't seem to appreciate its significance. I'm talking about the Patsy remark. I discussed that remark in the second episode of this podcast, but now that we know more about what was going on in Oswald's head on the night of the assassination, I want to take one more pass at the Patsy remark and see if we can extract just one more level of meaning from it.
Come on, man. No, they're taking me in because of the fact that I live in Missouri. I'm just a patsy.
They've taken me in because of the fact that I lived in the Soviet Union. As I pointed out in episode 2, this claim didn't make any sense at all, given that Oswald had been violently apprehended in the Texas Theatre just after the murder of J.D. Tippit by cops who had no idea what his name was, much less any idea that he had once lived in the Soviet Union. Oswald's line would have made sense only if he'd been arrested peacefully at his home or his workplace, by cops who were aware of his identity and his political past. In other words, this had to be a line that Oswald had prepared in advance when he was imagining a kind of ideal version of the president's murder in his head, and when he wasn't picturing any of the messy fallout that would accompany that act when he carried it out in real life, including the ugly fact that he would end up murdering a cop too. So when the Patsy remark is quoted in full, it doesn't just confirm Oswald's guilt, it also reveals something about his motive. It shows us that in Oswald's head, the murder of Kennedy was a Cold War act. It was one of those crimes that the authorities would round up and persecute the nearest lefties for, whether they were guilty or not. Mailer says that the four shots Oswald fired into Tippett were the first element in the loss of an heroic trial, and yet we have at least two clues that tell us that even after the shooting of Tippett, Oswald still seemed to think that an heroic trial was still on the table. The first clue is that he asked to be put in touch with John Abt, lawyer to the communist stars. The second is that just an hour after he first asked to be put in touch with Abt, he made his Patsy remark in the corridor. At some level, Oswald still seemed to imagine that if he went to trial, the global left would rally to his cause the way it had rallied to the causes of people like the Rosenbergs and Sacco and Vanzetti and Alger Hiss. If that was Oswald's wish, it sounds like an insanely optimistic one, and yet after his death, it came true to a remarkable degree. The global left did end up rallying to Oswald's cause in quite a big way, as we'll see when we look at the earliest conspiracy theories about Kennedy's murder and the way they grew out of the polarized politics of the era. I've said before that Oswald was the first conspiracy theorist in this case. He was also the first person to use left-wing doublethink to portray himself as an innocent man, despite the plain fact that he was guilty. And again, he would be far from the last person to do that. The irony here is that if Oswald had lived to have the heroic trial that he seemed to want, it would have been a fizzer, and he would have been found guilty in very short order. But when he died, the conspiracy theorists turned the case into exactly the sort of cause célèbre that he'd been hoping for, as if his death entitled him to an eternal presumption of innocence and to a trial that must never be allowed to end with any kind of verdict. I've quoted Norman Mailer a fair bit in this episode, and I'm about to do it one last time. One thing I want to do in this podcast is highlight the best writing and thinking that's been done about the Kennedy assassination, as well as quoting all the dubious conspiratorial stuff. And Mailer's Oswald's Tale is one of the two or three genuinely great books that have been written about this case. One thing that makes it such a great book is that in the course of writing it, Mailer did something that very few people associated with this case have ever done. He completely changed his mind about the question of conspiracy. By his own admission, Mailer was a conspiracy theorist when he started doing his research. He'd known Jack Kennedy personally, and he wanted Kennedy's assassin to have been someone bigger and better than Lee Harvey Oswald. But Mailer's opinion changed as he gathered his evidence. He went to Moscow and Minsk, and he interviewed people who had known Oswald there, and he read the KGB transcripts of all the conversations and petty arguments that Oswald and Marina had had in their bugged apartment. In Russia and in America, Mailer spoke to the people who had known Oswald the best, including Marina herself, and in the end, Mailer found that the weight of the evidence was just too much for him. In the final pages of his book, he wrote, "If one's personal inclinations would find Oswald innocent, or at least part of a conspiracy, one's gloomy verdict, nonetheless, is that Lee had the character to kill Kennedy and that he probably did it alone." That word character is important. Mailer's conclusion that Oswald probably did it alone isn't just based on the fact that he'd found no serious evidence of any conspiracy. It was also based on all the evidence he did find that showed what kind of person Oswald was. he was the kind of person who would have had the desire and the willpower to kill the president, and who would never in a million years have let anyone else help him do that. What purpose would that serve for him? Mailer writes. As we've seen, that's always the appropriate question to ask when you're dealing with Oswald. What purpose would that serve for him? It just wouldn't have been Oswald's style to involve himself in any sort of conspiracy, as Mailer goes on to explain. Quote, a conspiracy allows him to amount to no more than a cog in the machine. That could hardly be enough for the man who has been depicted over the length of this book. If one misperceives his character on this point, then one has misunderstood him entirely. There's that word character again. It just wasn't in Oswald's character to play a supporting role in somebody else's conspiracy. If you don't grasp that, says Mailer, you've misunderstood Oswald entirely. What Mailer found in the course of writing his book is that when you get to the bottom of who Oswald was, you realise that there's simply no need to believe there was a conspiracy. And if there's no need to believe something, we shouldn't believe it. Way back at the start of the previous episode, as I was getting started on the question of Oswald's motives, I quoted something that the conspiracy theorist Josiah Thompson said about Kennedy's murder. There was no why, Thompson said. Right from the beginning, we couldn't put a why answer on it. It seemed to be beyond that. I hope I've said enough over the past couple of hours to demonstrate that that claim is simply ridiculous. If you can't put a why answer on the Kennedy assassination, that can only be because you've made a more or less conscious decision to blind yourself to the reality of Oswald's political beliefs and his horrible personal qualities. The guy had motives coming out his ears. But from the very first days of the case, conspiracy theorists like Thompson have been studiously looking away from Oswald instead of at him. Oswald is like the sun for these people. They refuse to look at him directly for more than a few seconds at a time, as if at some level they're aware that the blazing light that he sheds on this case is enough to reduce all their cherished theories to a smoking ruin. Another thing I said at the beginning of the previous episode is that Oswald's motives were complicated, and they can't be summed up in a single sentence or soundbite. To prove that point, I've now spent something like 2.5 hours trying to unpack all the different political and psychological factors that fed into his crime. But now that we understand how complex the true picture is, I think it can be admitted that some soundbites do come closer to describing the truth about Oswald's motives than others do. And if I had to pick the one soundbite that comes closest to the bullseye, I'd pick something that Oswald's brother Robert once said. Robert Oswald was a realist. He didn't want to believe that his little brother had killed the president, but he had too much integrity to pretend that all the evidence that implicated him didn't exist. The facts are there, Robert said in 2013 in an interview with PBS. Enough's enough. It's there. Put it to rest. Then the reporter asked Robert the question that I've been trying to answer for the past 2 hours. The big question is why, the reporter said. What's the best answer you come to for yourself regarding his motive? And here's what Robert Oswald said in reply. To try to understand why Lee did what he did on November the 22nd is a cumulative effect of all his past plans and efforts and failures. Historically in his life, it was always done by himself. He planned by himself, he executed by himself, he failed by himself. This was a part of his character, that inner self that we used to say, me, myself, and I will do something. So if the conspiracy theorists insist that Oswald's motives must be summed up in a soundbite, I would choose that one, delivered by one of the few people in the world who really knew the man. And if I had to whittle that soundbite down to just a single sentence, I'd choose the sentence in the middle. He planned by himself, he executed by himself, he failed by himself. In effect, what Robert's saying there is that Oswald's motive was precisely to be a lone gunman. He wanted to show the world that he could do this huge thing by himself. All his other motives, his urge to hunt fascists, his obsession with Cuba, his desire to impress Fidel and have a heroic trial, all those things ran a distant second to Oswald's raging desire to be the world's most successful ever lone nut, the solo performer in a conspiracy of one. It's ironic that conspiracy theorists think they're doing Oswald some kind of favour when they insist that he was incapable of committing such a crime alone, or at all. Actually, they're selling the man short if the whole point of the exercise was to show that he could do it alone. You may be relieved to hear that the part of this podcast dealing in detail with Oswald and his motives is now done. In the next episode, we'll be moving beyond the dank confines of Oswald's mind and out into the wider world. But as we wrap up this discussion of why Oswald did what he did, I think it's only fair to give the last word to Oswald himself. Not that last word is the right term here, because the final clue Oswald gave the world about his motives didn't come in verbal form. It was a gesture which he made as he lay dying on a floor at Dallas City Hall after being shot in the belly by Jack Ruby. A detective at Oswald's side could see that he was dying, and he knelt down beside him and asked him if he had anything to confess. Here's how that detective described Oswald's last seconds on the planet. Quote, "Several times he responded to me by shaking his head in a definite manner. It wasn't from the pain or anything. He had just decided that he wasn't going to correspond with me. He wasn't going to say anything." And as Oswald shook his head for the last time, he lifted his arm and he gave what the detective described as, quote, "a definite clenched fist salute." In an important sense, the story of the Kennedy assassination ends there, as Oswald expires on a floor at City Hall with his fist defiantly raised. But the afterlife of the assassination and the epic story of JFK conspiracism hadn't even got off the ground yet, because when Oswald was fatally shot in police custody, a whole new set of questions was opened up. Who was Jack Ruby? What was his motive for shooting Oswald? Will we find any indications of a conspiracy there? Even if we don't, it can't be denied that for a lot of people, Ruby's shooting of Oswald was the last straw. A lot of people were ready to believe anything now, rather than believe in the unbelievable sequence of events that had happened in front of their eyes. When Ruby shot Oswald, the conspiracy theories about Kennedy's murder went next level. And we'll be following them there next time on The Ghosts of Dallas.
Now the prisoner wearing a black sweater, he has changed from his t-shirt, is being moved out toward an armored car, being led out by Captain Fritz. There is the prisoner. Do you have anything to say in your defense?
What?
There's a shot.
Oswald has been shot.
Oswald has been shot.